We call them digital natives, a generation that has grown up with technology as their first language, from playing video games in the crib to calculators in math class to submitting their high school English papers by email. So it shouldn't be surprising that online learning would be part of the educational experience going forward. But is that a good thing? Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. It's a big and complicated question, and today we're going to explore online learning. Really, we're talking about learning, period, and how the tools and methods are changing, and whether it may work better or just differently in the future. If you've been out of the academy for a while, you may want to take a deep breath because it is a different world. Joining us to talk about that world is Dr. Jennifer Friend. She's a professor in the School of Education here at UMKC. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And also David Ta. He's an instructional designer here at UMKC. Welcome to you, David.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from Irvine, California is Dr. Melissa Lobel. She's a dean in the distance learning program at the University of California, Irvine. Good morning to you, Dr. Lobel.
Thank you so much for having me as well.
We're glad you're here. Let's start by trying to focus the conversation a little as we get started. When we speak of online learning, and everybody seems to be speaking about it these days, what does that mean, Dr. Friend?
Well, I think there's informal online learning and there's formal online learning. Whichever one you look at, technology is transforming the way that we learn. It's more individualized, it's more student-centered. But in terms of formal learning, we're seeing at the high school level and at the college level more and more courses that are being offered through a 100% online format where a student would connect to the internet from a home, from a coffee shop, from work, wherever they are, and complete course activities. And then there are hybrid or blended courses where a student might come to a campus and sit in a face-to-face classroom for part of a class, and then the rest of the learning activities take place online. And then also there's online learning where a face-to-face class is augmented, so there may be course materials available or other resources available through a course website that's set up to support what's happening within the physical classroom.
So we're talking about some that's exclusively online, some that's a partnership or a collaboration of some kind.
Yes. I
wonder, are we talking about just college level and higher instruction, or is this happening with younger kids too?
It's definitely happening with younger kids. We see students who are homeschooled who are now being enrolled in virtual schools. A lot of high school students are enrolled in online classes. For example, here in Kansas City, the North Kansas City School District has actually been offering high school online classes for 10 years. And they started out with 3 classes and about 23 students, and they now offer 48 classes online with about 650 students, and all through the year, summer, fall, and spring semesters.
Well, I want to talk about some of the implications of these different styles, these different methods of education using online tools, but let's talk more specifically about what some of them are. A lot of folks say that this all started with something called the Khan Academy. David, are you able to talk about what the Khan Academy even is?
Well, the Khan Academy is basically taking very simple 2 to 5 minute lessons of how to do something, how to solve a equation or how to take a derivative, making it simple, short to watch, easy to watch, and basically taking them through the steps of how to do it like you would see a teacher write it in front of them on a chalkboard. And so this is available to students whenever they want and really however they can get access to it, whether it's through their mobile device or through traditional like laptops or desktops, computer.
So people talk about the Khan Academy as having sort of revolutionized education. Is that how you see it, Dr. Friend?
I definitely see the Khan Academy as having an influence. They have worked with a concept called a flipped classroom. For example, they have a math curriculum where students will basically do their online lesson outside of school. And then when they come to class, they're doing their homework, which typically would have been done outside of school. So the teacher is more facilitative, and the teacher can keep tabs through a tablet technology with which students are answering correctly, which students may need some assistance. And so that flipped classroom is a model that I think the Khan Academy has really been a leader in.
And Dr. Lobel, you work exclusively with distance learning there at Irvine, as I understand it. Obviously, I think one of the concerns people would have about something like Khan Academy is that with the student not being face-to-face with the teacher, that they're not being monitored. Is that how it works?
You know, in the Khan Academy's case, yes, the student is on their own learning those concepts. But what we're really seeing are instructors bringing in things like the Khan Academy into their fully online courses, where they're still very present. They're coaching students, they're encouraging interaction among the students in the class, and they're really helping students work through their learning, and then using resources like Khan Academy and other great online tools to really amplify that experience.
So one of the forms of sort of hybrid education that Dr. Friend was talking about is where there are regular traditional classroom courses that also involve the use of online tools. I know, Dr. Lobel, you used to work with Blackboard, one of the platforms. How does that work? How does it work for an online platform to be brought into the classroom?
Sure. What a lot of instructors like to do is take out of the class the kinds of activities that are, I would like to say, more passive or more independent for students. So they can experience those online, become more prepared for the class when they're in their normal traditional face-to-face class setting, and then be ready to dive into more active discussions, applications of the learning, labs, and other kinds of things that actually are more useful in that class setting.
And so can you give us some specific examples of that? Like, what would be some activity that at one time we might have thought of as being in class and now is something that would happen online?
Sure. So perhaps a traditional lecture or a presentation of some sort that's focused on content that could easily be acquired through either watching a video or could be acquired through reading materials, taking some quick self-check quizzes that you get feedback on. Those kinds of experiences could then be taken out of the classroom, handled online. And then when students walk into the class, the instructor could perhaps work through a case, present a situation, and have students break down that case and figure out how to handle that situation related to the subject matter.
I guess I have to wonder, do we think that a student watching a lecture on video on their computer screen is actually more effective than being in the classroom where that lecture is being offered, or is there no difference? David Ta, in your experience as an instructional designer, what do we think about that?
Well, for instructors that put their lectures online, the lectures tend to be a lot more controlled, and so they don't tend to be more free, extemporaneous, where they're talking and then they're injecting maybe a mistake or two here. But then whenever they create their lectures, they have the ability to go back, edit it, add stuff to it, and then deliver it in a format that's concise, and it delivers the content effectively to students. And so I think...
So it's like every lecture is a professor's best lecture rather than just whatever lecture they come up with that day.
Well, essentially, instructors, from my experience, many instructors feel comfortable sitting in front of a computer and then delivering the lectures and then putting it on in an online format. And so... I know for some of my instructors that I work with, professors that I work with, this is probably a preferred method to delivering lectures in the classroom live.
You're a professor, Dr. Friend. Is there a difference between speaking to a group of students in a classroom and speaking to a little camera?
I think there is a difference, and I basically do direct instruction in three different ways. If it's a face-to-face classroom, then I'm there, I'm interacting with the students. If something prompts a question or a discussion item, a student can raise their hand, and then we can talk about it in the moment. If I am recording a podcast, if I'm doing something, I use a tool called Tegrity to record a podcast. For example, my school finance class is online this semester, and so I'm going to have a PowerPoint presentation that's prepared in advance. I'm going to talk through that, and there'll be a little video of me live in the corner while I'm recording it that the students will see when they watch it. But some of the differences are that there's more individualized opportunity for learning, because if I put a link in that podcast, the student can pause, and then they can follow that link, and then they can come back to it. Or if they're going to get ready for an assessment, they can go back and they can rewatch that podcast. And then the third way is to do this in a synchronous format. So I use Wimba Classroom, and three times this semester in that online finance class, we'll meet online in real time. And there's a feature where students can actually raise their hand, and I can say, David, I see you have a question. Go ahead. And there's a running chat commentary. And so I see this, it's the same interaction in that synchronous environment.
David?
Well, And with the synchronous environment, one of the instructors that I'm working with this semester, she's teaching a public speaking online class. And so she is delivering her lectures in a synchronous format, but at the same time, she is doing activities that focuses in on oral presentation, public speaking, something that would be appropriate in a face-to-face, but it happens to work in a synchronous environment because everybody's present.
What about something like assessment? Dr. Lobel, obviously the conventional format would be at the end of a semester or maybe during the semester, quizzes, exams that people come into a room and write. Is that different in an online environment?
You know, I think the concept of assessing students' learning throughout the course experience is the same, but how we deliver that is different in an online environment. Now, if we're talking fully online, that means that students aren't even coming to campus to take that traditional final exam. So what they are doing instead are taking exams online, automated through the technologies that we have. We've even had students in our programs use online proctoring, where they go with virtual in a virtual setting, take their exam. They've got a proctor watching them over a webcam, making sure that they're not cheating and using materials as they may not be allowed to use. And so we even see that sort of traditional test translating using technology into the online space. The other thing that the online environment has really pushed forward is peer assessment. So an opportunity for students to complete assignments and then have other students assess or provide feedback in the learning process. And we're seeing this be used more and more in online environments. And I think that this gives students an opportunity also to interact with one another through that assessment, learn from multiple people in the course, not just their instructor, and still be engaged at a distance.
I want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation and invite you to assess this a little bit, pros and cons of this technology and learning. Especially we want to hear from you if you have had classes as a student or as a teacher online. Is it a good experience or a bad one? Is it different than going to a classroom? How is it different? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Maybe you're in class now and listening to our live stream, so you'll just have to shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. I'm curious from the two of you here from UMKC, where some of this is happening as part of courses here at UMKC, what the reaction has been like from faculty. I know a professor at another institution who teaches some courses online. He actually says he prefers it because he actually can keep track of what students are reading, how often they are online, how much time they're spending on their studies, things that in the past professors have only had to guess at. Is that uniformly the experience of faculty with these courses?
I would say that's not uniformly the experience. I think there is a wide variety of proficiency with technology, first of all, and then comfort level with the different pedagogical techniques or the instructional techniques that are successful in an online environment. And so I think there's a need for preparation for faculty or for teachers in K-12 settings if they're going to be teaching online. And that's where someone like David comes in with as an instructional technologist. He can help teachers to re-envision that face-to-face class as an online class and what needs to happen to make that effective.
Right, because it isn't just a matter of teaching the same lessons in the same way but to a camera, right?
Right. And so if you're going to approach online teaching the same way you approach face-to-face teaching, then you're not going to have a good experience. But then if you use technology as a tool and think of what students need to learn, then you can probably design activities and then appropriate the tools and to design something that would be beneficial to you and the students, and so both will have a good experience.
Dr. Lobel, when you have a fully developed distance learning program like the one you help lead there at UC Irvine, do you get regular professors from the university to teach their courses in this program, or is it a different set of faculty with different skills and different interests? Are there a lot more adjuncts from outside the university?
Yeah, so depending on the environment in which we're offering the distance learning, we may get faculty from campus. In fact, there are quite a few faculty very interested in taking their traditional online and their traditional face-to-face class and transitioning it online for all of the reasons that we've been discussing and even just the flexibility. The one thing, though, they do realize is that you're teaching shifts. You don't show up for 3 hours to lecture in a classroom and then make sure you're available for office hours. You instead are now checking in on students regularly throughout the week. And for some faculty, that's really appealing to them. We also have a pretty extensive adjunct instructor pool that supports our continuing education distance learning programs. And in that case, we can bring in experts from the field from all over the world to teach our students and really be able to provide them with experience that they may not actually be able to get if it was a face-to-face class here on campus.
And do you worry about pushback? I mean, I wonder from some of these faculty who you've all sort of alluded to some faculty struggling with this transition. Is that just a matter of being resistant to change as all people are, or do they have some legitimate beefs?
I think some of that is the resistance to change. But I think as you started the show talking about digital natives, I think a lot of faculty are digital immigrants. And they grew up, as I did, I wasn't introduced to a computer until junior high. So I'm actually on the early side of that in terms of a lot of faculty as an early adopter of technology. But I think that's something to take into account is just that comfort level with technology, first of all, and then overcoming some of the beliefs like an online class can't be as rigorous or an online class just can't have the quality that you can get in a face-to-face environment.
Dr. Friend, did you want to add something there as well? Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Lobel, did you want to add something as well?
Sure. I
apologize. I heard both of you speaking and I misspoke your names.
No problem. No, I was just going to share that, there is some research that indicates that using technology in a hybrid setting can even be more beneficial than a traditional setting, and that definitely using technology online can do the same. But I think faculty are concerned that their students aren't going to be able to have that social experience or the socialization associated with the course that they traditionally get in a face-to-face environment. So trying to find ways to make sure it's not just about test outcomes that, show that online learning can be as effective as traditional learning, but instead find ways to help faculty understand how to make sure that socialization can come into their class in an online experience. I think they're very concerned about that as well.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking about online learning, the possibilities and potential problems. 816-235-2888 is the number to call if you want to be part of the conversation. Jeff in Richmond, Missouri, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi there. I had an interesting experience with online learning quite recently. It was entirely positive. I'm 66 years old, so I'm not one of the kids who grew up with tech. On the other hand, I was an IT professional before I retired, so, I'm not out in space with it. But I took a course on playing American blues on the harp. And people think harp, they think harmonica, but this is, let me define this as an antique instrument with lots and lots of strings.
So you took an online class in playing the blues on the harp, which strikes me as the kind of thing that you would normally take from someone who knows how to do that in person, sitting next to you and helping you do it.
We took it from someone who knows how to do that. In fact, she is probably the world's most famous blues harpist. Her name's Deborah Hanson Conant.
And how did it work learning it online, Jeff?
She did a combination of things. She did text, which she posted so that we could download them, written music. We had written music. We had text files to read from. We had play-along files, which she would play the background, and we would download those, and then we would play the lead part along with it. Each week she had a chat on the weekend, and then she created a private Facebook page for all the students to participate in. And each week we had homework. And if we chose, it was an extra fee to have your homework reviewed and receive the review. But if we chose to do that, we recorded our homework on a video camera. And then we posted that on a private posting on YouTube that she could review. And then she would send us back in video form her review of our work with also a text message. The deal is there are not that many people who want to learn how to play the blues on a harp in any given city, right?
So there's not enough to offer a full class, but she was able to do it for those across the country who had an interest.
The world.
That's great.
We had students in Austria. We had students in Australia. We had students in Scotland.
Interesting, Jeff. I really appreciate your call. David, is this a typical story? Is this the kind of thing that's being taught online?
Well, I haven't heard of a harp class.
Okay, that's your first introduction to the blues harp class. But is that but music, humanities, things that people might not expect to have?
Yeah,
online
people
courses?
Are taking technology and appropriating in ways to do this sort of thing, and it reaches a wide variety of people across a vast amount of space, like in Missouri, in California, in Austria. And this is one of the benefits to taking an online class, is that you can be in different spaces, take the class, and then have a set amount of time to do it rather than 11 o'clock every Tuesday and Thursday.
Right. You can take those harp classes at 11 p.m. if you want to, in the privacy of your home.
Correct.
Yeah. Dr. Friend?
Thinking also about the high school students, if you are attending a rural school, maybe a small school, and you're interested in taking advanced classes like calculus or advanced placement English, oftentimes if it's a high school of only 65 students, it's difficult to find teachers who are qualified and to be able to offer those advanced courses or diverse foreign languages. Maybe a school can offer Spanish, but a student's really interested in learning other languages. Mm-hmm. And so this is a cost-effective way to expand learning opportunities for students in high school where they're still physically in the high school, but at a certain time during the day, they're going to go and they're going to get online and they're going to be taught by an instructor that's highly qualified in these areas and have the opportunity to get those advanced classes.
And Dr. Lobel, I wonder, I mean, Jeff, our caller, mentioned the sort of the cost effectiveness. You can offer a class that people around the world will take when you couldn't put together enough students who are interested in one city. Is that something you're finding? Are you able to offer a wider variety of classes because of that?
Absolutely. Not only are we able to offer a wider variety of classes, we can attract students from all over the world, which just makes, I think, the classes much more rich because of the kind of engagement you can have from people of all different backgrounds. It's also interesting for us. Similarly, we're bringing courses out to the high schools in order to make sure that students are more college prepared as well. And so we can offer some of those advanced courses or unique courses. We're offering an introduction to music course to some of our local high schools for similar reasons, and so that students can not only be enriched in this way where they may not have this opportunity at their school, but they become more college prepared as they come to us as incoming freshmen.
David?
Right, and think of people who are serving in the military, who are overseas, who are deployed, and if they're based in Fort Leavenworth, for example, and they have a lot of credits at UMKC, they can take a distance online course, be deployed overseas, do their work as they would, and then get a college degree from it. And this is benefits for them, and it benefits us.
You know that locally, Park University is another college that has a lot of military students in their programs. Let's talk to Bradley in Kansas City, Missouri. Bradley, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. How you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
I just want to say that I'm a full-time parent, I guess, there, and a single parent, and also I work full time as well. It's really difficult for me to go to class, so the online course works really well. And it's, I think the pros definitely outweigh the cons. But I will say this: the social interaction might be in question there. So you've already touched on it already, but somehow you have the class on how people get to learn to work and play well with each other somehow. Mm. When they get their degree somehow.
So sort of the social education that you get by being in school or in college seems to be missing.
If they're taking courses online, yes. Nope. I mean, some people didn't. I mean, I've worked over 20 years in the military, of course, and I work full-time for the fire department when the department's here in Kansas City, and then somehow people need to learn how to work and play together.
Okay,
and
good.
You can't get that online.
I appreciate that, Bradley. That's a good question. I'm sure it's one that a lot of listeners have. You know, we've talked about how faculty and students can interact fairly thoroughly in online education, but is there a way for students to really interact with each other?
Well, each time I teach an online class, I start with a getting acquainted forum. And it's interesting because I'll have some of the same students in an online class that I've previously had in a face-to-face class, and I'll learn things in that online environment where every student's voice is heard that I had not known, even having them one or two semesters in the traditional classroom setting, things about hobbies, things about their families. And so I think if you create those opportunities for communication and structure it in such a way that there is learner interaction in addition to the interaction between the student and the instructor, that there are some opportunities. But that having been said, part of the value of getting a college degree is some of those relationships and networking that are formed. And I think that traditional university programs do a better job of leading to those contacts for future employment. And so it's important, I think, for online instructors and universities or online programs to address is how you do address some of those issues around networking and following up with graduates to make sure that their experiences in online education are leading to successful professional opportunities.
Dr. Lobel, is there an online equivalent to sitting late until midnight eating popcorn and watching movies in your dorm room?
That's a great question. I do agree that there are ways that you can bring in socialization or interaction elements among students in your courses, like that welcome forum that was described. You can do things throughout the course in groups or in small class settings where students are required to interact with one another to produce an assignment or an activity or do an experience. So I think you can really bring that in. But I agree that extra socialization element that you get in the informal experiences at a university or college, really that's hard to replicate in an online environment.
David, you were saying?
Yes, and this is probably one reason why some instructors are incorporating social network tools such as Facebook, Twitter, Google+ into the classroom so they can get the educational benefits to using Google+ or Facebook, as well as the socialization. So students are seeing each other's posts, they're seeing images of one another, and they're seeing maybe if they have privacy settings off within the group, they can see what they're doing that day. And so that sort of helps build closeness within the classroom between students, mm-hmm. in a way that sort of you won't get in a face-to-face classroom. So I might not speak to, say, Jennifer, she was a classmate sitting next to me, but then I might see her on Facebook and see what she does, and that sort of makes me feel closer to her in a way.
So the interaction is not necessarily as social, but it is still interactive.
Right. I mean, it's interactive, and it's also social because you're seeing what each other is doing, and you're sort of connected in that way.
Let's talk to Bill in Lenexa. Bill, welcome to Central Standard. Bill, are you still?
How are you today?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Very good. So my question relates to, first of all, I support online education, particularly I'm a fan of the hybrid model. But one of my concerns particularly is, how do you influence the character development? Because one of the things that higher education has suffered from is actually a disenfranchising, if you want to say, or a move away or abdicating a professor's responsibility to influence the character development of the students. So I think that's a potential drawback to pure online programs, is the loss of that ability to influence that. And we're not just talking the social aspect, but the ability to engage in those ethical discussions and stuff that could be more difficult in a non-face-to-face environment.
Bill,
I'd be interested to see what they have to say.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, and you're certainly not the only one to ask that question as one of the real risks of online learning. Dr. Lobel, is there a particular way that your institution tries to instill character development alongside the A's, B's, and C's?
You know, much of that character development we do leave up to the faculty here at UC Irvine. However, I've been teaching online now for about 10 years in a program for Pepperdine, and that program's a master's program. And one of the things that we really focus on in that program is making sure that students have the skills to be successful in their careers, and many of those skills revolve around how do you interact with your colleagues online, through email, through texting. How do you, present to others online? Because oftentimes we're called upon to speak to or have conversations with others at a distance. And so part of that character development for us becomes about how do we teach people those skills for interacting with others at a distance for your employment environment. And I would argue that that's a bit of some character development there. That's how are you able to influence others with your ideas? How are you able to present your ideas in the appropriate tone online? So we place a specific emphasis on that.
We need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to dig a little more deeply into these hybrid courses in classrooms that also make use of the technology. We have calls from Sarah and Caitlin, who both want to talk about their experiences with that, as well as continued conversations with David Taw, an instructional designer here at UMKC, Dr. Jennifer Friend, who teaches in the School of Education here, and Dr. Melissa Lobel, who is a dean in the distance learning program at UC Irvine. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to be part of our conversation. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. You are listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about online learning, about the pros and cons of traditional classrooms making use of, or in some cases being replaced by, technology and online interaction between teachers and students and between students with each other. Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. In the next half hour, we'll talk a little bit about hybrid classes, classes that are both traditional and use online elements, but also about some of the trends in online education, including gamification and badges. If you know what I'm talking about, then you're well ahead of much of the public. And also about MOOCs. Yes, MOOCs. We'll even explain what those are. 816-235-2888. My guests are Jennifer Friend of UMKC, David Taw of UMKC, and also Melissa Lobel of UC Irvine. Sarah in Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. You had a question about hybrid learning, I understand.
Yes, I'm at the Barstow School in Kansas City, Missouri, and we have launched a program where we have upper school credit online courses, and we're building a consortium of schools that can then benefit from these courses because it provides flexibility and breadth of offerings and globalization, all of the wonderful things that you guys have been chatting about. But as a college preparatory school, one of the things that we really are focused on and hoping to accomplish is that we're creating a continuity from our courses to the ever-present expectations of online learning in the higher education environment. Mm-hmm. But are there partnerships? Are there opportunities that you see that can create that bridge? Because it's almost like two separate arms are starting to build. You know, the presence of online learning is there, but now finding that bridge from students who are experiencing it in a high school environment to students who will be facing it in higher ed.
Great question, Sarah. Let me ask all of our guests, is there a significant difference between the high school experience and the college experience, and are there partnerships to try to bridge that gap? Dr. Jennifer Friend.
I think there are partnerships that are forming, and there have been partnerships in the past between high schools and colleges for early college programs where students can earn dual credit, a high school credit for English at the same time they're earning college credit. And so now what we're seeing is that instead of the student having to get up early in the morning or go late to go to campus or be bused from the high school to the college campus to engage in those college classes, that now the student can work from home or they can work online while they're at school to engage in the higher education environment. I think also more and more high school students are getting involved with online learning. There was a study that was published by the Sloan Foundation that said by the year 2016 that there will be 5 million K-12 students enrolled in online courses prior to high school graduation. And so that brings to mind Sarah's question. So what are we doing to look at that bridge between the way that online courses are structured for these high school students and the way that they're structured in the higher education environment?
Let's talk to Caitlin in Lawrence, who has another question about hybrid classes. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, I attend school at Washburn University, and I've had the opportunity this semester to take both hybrid and online classes. One of the things I notice is sometimes I feel like the online classes are sometimes a bit more challenging. There's more that's required. But with the hybrid classes, there's a feeling that the teacher is there to kind of remind you and guide you and keep you calm as far as, you know, you're going to get through the assignments. And I just wanted to know, you know, what your perspective is on those two differences.
Yeah, good question. The difference that students experience in terms of teacher interaction, David, I wonder if in your experience it's the students who sometimes need to make the adjustments, not just the teachers.
Right. People who are used to face-to-face classes, and when they take an online class for the first time without realizing the amount of work that they have to do within an online class, sometimes can be challenging. It can be disenfranchising to some students. And for them, sometimes the instructors would need to remind them through email or through some other form of technology, hey, that an assignment is due at the end of the week. And so if a student does not log in to do their work, they can sometimes forget that they have work due. And so this is one of the issues that is important with instructor-student communication.
Yeah, we had a tweet from KC Live Music Blog, who tweeted us at KCURCST, says that online classes are hit and miss. I enjoy learning at my own pace, but I need hands-on to really grasp a concept. And I do imagine that there's a heavy amount of responsibility the student has to embrace. Dr. Lobel, how do you ensure that students embrace it?
You know, we for students that want to take online courses here, we make sure that up front they understand what's required or what's necessary for success in those courses. And quite a bit of that is this online commitment to completing things and being able to work independently. However, we also ensure that our instructors are present at a very minimum every 48 to 72 hours in some fashion in the course. And this encourages students to continue and move through the work. It encourages them to reach out for questions. It encourages them often to interact with one another. Just knowing that somebody's there, even if not directly interacting with the student, just having that instructor present is really important for, you know, encouraging students to continue through the course.
And how often are the students expected to be present in the course?
You know, we often encourage instructors to craft activities that require students to be present in the same kind of vein, every 48 to 72 hours at the very least. We really believe that that's important, that students aren't just coming in on weekends and perhaps completing their course and then are gone for another week. We think that continuous experience or that continuous connection in the course helps them be more engaged and actually helps solidify the learning.
Well, it strikes me as I reflect on my own college and perhaps even grad school experience where just going to class, showing up for class, does not necessarily amount to engagement. You can go in your slippers and pajamas to class if you really want to, but having to actually do something, produce some kind of work, answer some kind of question, that would change my experience as a student. Is that what you found as well?
Absolutely. We think that making sure that there's a connection point frequently in the course, particularly in online courses, fully online courses, is really critical for students succeeding in that course.
One of the things I want us to talk about before we go back to some calls is one of the really fast-growing parts of the online learning world, and that's the world of MOOCs. We've thrown this acronym around. Let's go ahead and define what that means. Melissa Lobel at UC Irvine, what is a MOOC?
It is a massive open online course. What it means is it's a free course. Anyone can sign up and take it. And it is available to very large numbers of students, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of students at any given time.
So one of the first and well-known examples of this was this class at Stanford that a professor taught on artificial intelligence that sort of got this trend started, right? But what happened with that, David?
Well, if it's the same course that I'm thinking about, it's through a website called Udacity. And so students go through short videos about the subject. They're engaging videos, actually. And towards the end of the videos, they're usually 2 or 3 minutes each. There's an activity that you have to do, like a programming activity that you have to do. And so you're getting student engagement, you're getting feedback, and then you're getting that feeling that someone's talking to you through a video. And so this is one of the things that's really appealing to MOOCs, other than the fact that you can do it anytime and it's free.
That was that course had 150,000 students or something like that registered, and something like 23,000 of them took the exam at the end of the course and passed. And the reflection was that professor probably won't teach that many students in the flesh in the rest of their life as they had in that one course online.
Yeah, and really, one of the great things about these MOOC courses that I've seen and that some of the courses that I went through myself. Towards the end of the experience, I had some sort of artifact. I had a project that I can show off to people. Look, I created this digital item right here that I'm really proud of. And so this is something very purposefully done with many of the MOOCs that are popular out there.
And so a lot of these MOOCs are becoming well-known. They're connected to big, famous universities, and they're also free. How is that changing our understanding of education, Dr. Friend?
Well, I think that having these opportunities for people across the world is an investment in human capital. And so while they might not be earning a grade or they might not be getting credit toward a degree, they are getting marketable knowledge and skills, which, as David said, it could be something they could take in a portfolio to a potential employer. It could be a website that they've built. So if they have a resume and a link to their website, then people can go and they can have proof of what it is that they're able to do.
And let's talk a little bit about that proof. And I think that might be something important about all of the online learning we're talking about, which is the question of how employers and others will see degrees that are earned in this way or even non-degrees that are not earned in this way, how they'll see that as legitimate preparation for careers or for life. How are students who are passing these courses, especially the ones in non-degree programs like MOOCs, putting that into practice as something that they can market about themselves? David?
Well, some of the things that I've read about with students going through these MOOCs and building these portfolios are getting picked up by major companies such as Google, Microsoft, people who are tech companies. And so there are ways that that students can put their works online, and then recruiting companies could scan the codes, the works that students are building, and then these are getting picked up by companies and they're off getting job offers based on those works. And so you don't necessarily have to have a traditional degree in those cases because you're showing that you can actually do what they want.
But does anyone care if I've earned my economics badge on out of Udacity, or if I've earned my calculus badge out of the Khan Academy? Does that count for something?
Well, if you think about the spirit of entrepreneurship, that counts. You might not be going out and trying to take your badge to get a job with an employer. You might be starting your own company, and you might be building apps that you're selling. We've got students in middle school now who are creating apps and making money. We've got students in high school who are designing websites and getting paid as graphic designers. And so the world's a little different. It's not that you have to have a degree from Harvard or Princeton. Typically, those employers see that, and they have the illusion of understanding the capabilities because it comes from a prestigious institution. But it's really not a guarantee of knowledge or skills that the individual has, whereas if you can have some evidence of a project that you've created, or you can show potential employers or clients for your own business the work that you're capable of doing, then that is a strong statement.
Which sort of brings us to the question of the future of traditional education, right? If you are saying that employers do not necessarily need to look to these new forms of education as better or worse, but just as something different, do you see a risk as for traditional institutions like colleges and universities that they will become more obsolete, less valued in what they have to offer? Dr. Lobel?
You know, it's a question that's really being asked by a lot of people right now, and I don't think that traditional education is going to go away. What I do think is it's going to incorporate the use of these technologies more robustly in the offerings that it provides. So, for example, we're seeing states legislate that students must experience an online course at some point during their college experience in order to be better prepared for when they go into the workplace and have to learn in an online fashion in order to gain the skills they need to be successful. You know, we're seeing MOOCs be brought into the class. In fact, we're working with a MOOC right now where faculty are using it in their traditional class, but using it as ancillary experiences for the students in order to more deepen their learning. And so we're just seeing the use of these technologies, the use of these different opportunities as a way to enhance what we're offering in the traditional institution. But I don't believe that the traditional institution is going away anytime soon.
Is there a concern about cost with traditional education? We've all been hearing about the student loan debate in Congress. We've paid a lot of attention recently to the costs of traditional college education. It seems like this could bring education to a lot more people less expensively. Is that true, Dr. Friend?
I think that the rising costs of tuition in traditional university programs are part of this discussion, and the fact that online programs could be more appealing to students because they are less expensive is a factor. But what you're seeing right now with the federal government and student loans is that they're wanting this evidence of quality so that any private institution that's opening up an online school or an online degree program, that they can demonstrate that there is value in that degree, that those students are going to be able to get jobs and pay back those students' loans after they have graduated. So that's very important in terms of accrediting higher education institutions and demonstrating that that quality is present in an online degree program.
David, one of your jobs here at UMKC, as I understand it, is to kind of be on the cutting edge of this, helping teachers and students adapt to whatever's next in this world. What is next? What are the next big things in online education?
Well, we talked about MOOCs in terms of it being appropriate, being used in like a free-form stand or within the classroom as ancillary. But one of the other trends that is going on right now in terms of education and technology is gamification. And so what we see with gamification is we're taking game elements, like traditional game elements that we think of in video games, and then incorporating in non-game settings. And so
give us an example, traditional game element.
So let's say a scoreboard is one, badging is another, reward system, competition, and so there's a...
And badging, just for our listeners who don't know off the top of their head, what you're talking about is what?
So think of badging as like a Boy Scout badge, for example. So if you demonstrate a certain competency or a certain skill, then you might get a badge and say, in this area, if you know how to tie a rope in this way, you get a badge in tying this rope because you can demonstrate that you can tie a rope in a certain way. And so with badging, it's just thinking differently about how to assess students in a different way rather than the traditional that we think of.
Do students get into this as sort of a fun way to learn? I mean, is it oversimplifying to say that they have more fun doing it and that's why they learn better?
Well, I actually taught my first gamified class this past summer, and David helped me to design it. And it was a class on school law. And whereas typically I might say, okay, during week three, that's going to be our unit on religion and public schools, and we're going to study the laws and the cases and that type of thing. With this gamified model, students were allowed to work more at their individual pace, and there were still those opportunities for student interaction throughout the semester. There were case scenarios, and those were opportunities for students to apply their learning in addition to the online quizzes. But once students demonstrated mastery of each unit, then they were free to move on to the next unit. So if they could demonstrate mastery and understanding of those concepts related to religion and public schools, and it only took them 5 days instead of 7 days, then they could move on to the next unit. And students seem to really enjoy that, especially since it was a summer class, because if they finished early, then that's more time for family and relaxation before the new school year started.
Right. Makes sense. Paul in Liberty, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions or comments about MOOCs and online learning.
Yeah, just very quickly, if you would, Paul.
Economics of MOOCs, they're free. Who pays the professor who puts the MOOC online? And secondly, so much of this online learning relies on online information, all of that information that's online had to be researched and generated at some point. And if nobody's paying for this, is this a sustainable model? I'll take my answer off line.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate your call. A good question, Dr. Lobel. What is the business model that makes MOOCs work? How can they be free?
Yeah, so for institutions initially getting into the MOOC world, it was really the institution itself that funded the development and then the subsequent teaching of that MOOC. A lot of times faculty gave up their own time to do it, and instructional designers gave up their own time to develop these courses. We're now seeing, though, that the various MOOC providers out there are looking for different models for monetization, whether it's a small fee to take a course to get an authenticated certificate that says you completed this, practice, or whether it's ancillary services like tutoring or proctoring or things that go alongside that, they're looking for new ways to generate funds to then share those funds back with the institutions in order to pay for the development of these. But like I said, many institutions have jumped into this world and given their free time and free experience and free teaching in order to make these MOOCs happen.
I'm thinking of in-app purchases online where you can play the Scrabble game for free, but if you want help with spelling words, you have to pay 99 cents more.
Exactly.
Dr. Friend?
One thing, I know we're talking about the institutional costs, but there are costs for the student as well. And some individuals might have some limitations in terms of their accessibility to technology. So individuals living in poverty, individuals with disabilities, or non-traditional students, it's a consideration in terms of a gap in technology that needs to be addressed. So even if a course is free, you still need to have the technology that's capable of playing those podcasts. You've got to have an internet connection. And so that's a consideration also in terms of equity of opportunity, even in online environments.
I'm going to try to squeeze one more call in from Fred in Kansas City, Missouri. Fred?
Hi. Before I ask my quick question, I know there's a revolution in education because my own alma mater, Northwestern Law School, is being challenged about whether law school should be 3 years or 2 years.
Sure.
I'm interested in how you recruit adjunct faculty and how you support them. I'm a retired attorney. I was a civil rights and tax attorney for the government, and I helped collect millions of dollars.
Okay, Fred, I'm going to cut you off because we've only got about 10 seconds left. How do we recruit? How do you select online instructors? Dr. Friend?
We have a course director, and so the online instructor is going to work to teach that class, but they're going to have guidance not only from our instructional technologists, but from faculty who work full-time in our programs to help them to get through that class.
Thank you so much, and I apologize for cutting you off there, Fred, and I'm sorry to Dave in Kansas City that I didn't get to take your call. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Jennifer Friend. She's a professor at the School of Education at UMKC. David Taw is an instructional designer here at UMKC, and Melissa Lobel is dean in the distance learning program at UC Irvine. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to our podcast and hear this conversation again. You can actually hear any of our previous shows at the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Hope you'll tune in tomorrow as we explore the meaning of masculinity. Stay tuned now for Up to Date. They're coming up with a preview of the fall TV season and also a look at why there are 2,000 zoo and aquarium staffers in Kansas City right now. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.